Welcome, ladies and gents, to the Grim and Bloody Podcast. This show is a presentation of horror, thriller, and suspense, and is intended for a mature audience. Join us at your own risk.
Welcome to another episode of the Grim and Bloody Podcast. Glad you're with us here as we count down to the new year, 2024. Final show of the year, gents. Tonight we have Scooter Corkle, director of the Friendship Game that is streaming right now on Shudder. Welcome, Scooter, to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Absolutely, absolutely. I'm going to introduce my cohorts, Al Omega, Creature Features. How you doing, Al?
I'm holding my own. Cough is finally starting to wind down, and it's not a moment too freaking soon, let me tell you.
Yeah, I've been sick for like, feels like the last 3 weeks. I'm just feeling good today. Joe Flynn, how you doing, Joe?
I'm doing great, amigos.
All right. Kevin Nicholson.
When I hear Al saying I'm holding my own, I really want to ask the question, is that all you're holding,
Al? Hey, mine is a lot to hold to start with, okay?
No, I'm glad to have you back, Al, and it's great to be here. It's great to talk Friendship Game with Scooter Corkle.
Absolutely, absolutely, Scooter. And congratulations on getting your film on Shudder, which we consider here one of the preeminent horror streaming platforms out there. It's one of the paid platforms, so we expect a certain level of quality, you know, when they're charging your card every month. And the Friendship Game definitely has the look of it. You want to tell us a little bit about it?
Sure, and thank you. The Friendship Game is, you know, it's a group of teenagers in a small town that discover a strange object that tests the strength of their friendship. So pretty classic premise. And really what we were hoping to do and tried to do was create sort of a cosmic horror movie that lived within that pantheon. That's basically the long and short, the very short actually.
You're right when you mentioned the cosmic angle, because I did wonder at the end of the film, kind of has an open ending. I saw opportunity for a film about the creation of this object, this cube, and how that came about. That often can be just as fascinating, if not more so, as the as the origin story, as they call it. Is that something that you are considering on doing at this point?
Damien Ober, the writer, and I have discussed very loosely trying to do something else within that pantheon for sure. I mean, the strange object itself is, you know, it's almost Lovecraftian. It's in its own universe, and a lot of what it does is it sort of scrapes from realities close to you, so just beyond your sort of universe or right inside your universe, and it creates a gameplay for the kids to test their friendship. So, I mean, you know, to us, it's timeless. It doesn't really feel like it fits anywhere specific, like it's always existed and never existed. So in a sense, yeah, I think there is a great opportunity to do something a lot more with that object. And a lot of the, you know, a lot of the wording and a lot of the lettering and all those sort of things that were built within that object are different languages and dead languages and pieces that we were sort of taking inspiration from with Richard Simpson, who's our production designer, who designed the thing and pitched it to us as this ancient evil that just kind of always has existed, infinite as the universe, you know. So yeah, it's kind of fun.
That's where I see that there's that origin story to it that can be quite interesting, you know. And I thought I'd like to see more about how this this object was created. And did you have was there a certain definitive design making the object octagonal? that the shape of the object was something that kind of struck me, as well as the lettering that the almost was almost like hieroglyphic lettering that's on the object itself. Did you? It's an important thing to, you know, to have something, the shape of the object presented in a film like this. Was that something that you went with, the octagonal?
Yeah, we talked a lot about it. Some of it had to do with like the actual design to make it look cool, but a lot of it had to do with having interlocking layers. So there's there's technically four layers to it. Outer shell that has one language, an inner crust that has another language, a third inner crust that has a different one that's more shapes, and then sort of the core, which again has its own sort of alien language, all written on it. So if you do have close-ups and stuff on it, you can actually see what we've built in there. And the idea is that, you know, all of these interlocking layers start to rotate and spin, and you don't know how deep it goes, like how microscopic it goes with inside the game itself, to really sort of open a portal or to, you know, again, scrape from another reality or the reality you're within. So yeah, all of that was very specifically built for sure.
It reminded me of the the Lament configuration for all you Hellraiser fans. That it's the MacGuffin, right? It's I like to call it the rabbit's foot because I'm a huge Mission Impossible fan, but it's like it's the object that everyone else is fighting for, using, you know, flowing through. It's the ground zero from where everything starts and everything just blossoms around it. I thought it was very well done. I thought it was intricate. It was detailed enough that you found it intriguing, but it didn't take away from the story. It didn't like overwhelm you, like, you know the Infinity Gauntlet, for example. It was the right proportion, I felt, for the story. But I wanted to segue into your lead actress, who I thought was hands down, although she was the lead actress, she carried the movie very well, and that was Peyton List. And she played the character of Zuza, if I remember the name right.
That's correct, yeah.
From beginning to end, she brought a gravity. Even the scenes, it was, you know, non-linear. You had to pay close attention, otherwise you might get lost, but her presence in the scenes kind of held it steady. Talk about the casting of Peyton and how you thought of her performance in the movie.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of our whole cast. I really, I thought we got really lucky with all of our lead cast. Peyton was a big grab for us. We did have, at some point, we had Bella Thorne attached. And she was going to play Zuza for a year or so, I think, before we really started to kick off and find some cash. She dropped out. We had scheduling conflicts with her. And then Peyton, within a weekend, had read it. And I had a meeting with her, and she was super down. And she really wanted to kind of push outside of what she'd done normally, I think. And yeah, she really went for it. And, you know, a lot of kind of how I work with cast is I try to cast according to what somebody sort of surprises me with, where they show me a side of a character that I think I know, but they really kind of embody it in a different way. Casting to me is all about like finding somebody who is that character already, so you're not really doing too much work once you're on set, and then allowing them to build the character themselves. So for Peyton, she really kind of took that and rolled with it and made Zuza her own. And I really appreciated sort of all the work that she had done. So yeah, we got really lucky with Peyton.
Now, with what Anthony was saying about Peyton, I was most impressed with Dylan Schombing, who, as Kyle, is this really kind of creepy, quiet, you know, character. And I kept wondering, you know, is he central to, you know, to the story? He's watching, you know, the events that take place as the others go, you know, through the security camera. You know, as the others play the game and so forth, is there something that directly involves him? And I thought that you picked the perfect actor, at least physically, to to essay the part. And was that something that you saw, that maybe Dylan was just right for this, for Kyle?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I'd seen him in The Watchmen. I'd seen him in a few other things too. And you know, he's a local guy. He just has that look, that creepy kid look that you can kind of fall for. Mm-hmm. But the one thing I felt that was interesting is that you have this sort of like creepy kid who's overseeing everything, but at the same time is really trying to find that loneliness in him. And really trying to kind of ground him as a real person as much as possible. So, you know, having Dylan sort of emote within the sort of the structure of what that character was, I think was really important to kind of, you know, round out who Kyle Jr. was. I like Dylan a lot. Yeah.
Right.
No, that's fantastic on both the lead actress and your actor. I just had a question about, you know, I really enjoyed the score of the film.
Mm.
And so wanted to commend you on that.
Thank you. Yeah. Yeah. Blitz Berlin, who again are some, they were like a local band forever. Local is in Canada, at least. They're kind of split up across the country in Vancouver and Toronto. But I had heard some of the stuff they did on the, they did some short films for the Blade Runners. So the like 2036 Nexus Dawn they were doing. And they did Psycho Goreman as well. As the composers on that. And I had a meeting with them and they were just sort of they really instantly grasped what I wanted to do. And then it didn't really take much because I just kind of let them go and do. And, you know, we had conversations around what instrumentation would sound cool. There's something called a bone flute in there that we use a lot that they showed me and discovered for part of the soundtrack itself. It's such a joy, that soundtrack. I'm so, so pumped on what came about from that. And I'm glad you did too. I'm glad you noticed as well.
Yeah, it is. And Al, if you're going to ask a question, go for it. I guess it's me.
There you go.
There you go, Al. Take it.
It's been a little sticky here. No, I was just saying that, you know, I was just remarking that, you know, Psycho Gorman, something else we know.
So mm-hmm.
Doing other works as well. It's kind of interesting, talking about Kyle Jr. there, he's being the watcher. And he's got all these recordings. We don't really go into how he gets them, how he's hacked.
Mm-hmm.
His background at all, though. I would have liked to have seen a little bit more about him. Because he's kind of an enigmatic character, but maybe that's what you were looking for.
Yeah, he's kind of like, and I don't disagree, we were kind of looking at him as the unofficial fifth member of the Friendship Game. Because he's inadvertently watching them play it. And because this object is scraping from every reality around it, it's also scraping from this digital reality, which then becomes Dylan as this vessel that it uses to really start trapping them within, you know, the game itself. And yeah, we had like one or two little scenes to kind of flesh out what Kyle Jr. might be, but overall, yeah, we didn't have a ton of him in there.
I did get the impression that he's kind of a little bit of a pawn of a greater power within that cube, though, in a sense that he
Absolutely,
is
yeah.
also being, as you say, the fifth member of the Friendship, that he's also being tested.
Yeah, exactly. And he's, you know, he is so lonely that the only friends he has are these digital facsimiles of people that live in his town. And that therein sort of lies the sort of like sadness that envelops who that character is. Like, he really wants friends. And to him, these four people are his friends, even though they've never really met him. And then he gets dragged into the whole game itself, and in a lot of ways is sort of the really kind of the worst of them all, because he becomes a tool that the object actually uses and physically uses. So poor Kyle Jr.
Talk a little bit about Brendan Meyer, because I thought if any guy was, if characters were, you know, just the nice guy being exploited, the nice guy that's involved in this, I really thought his character of Rob is, you know, he's the guy, his biggest fear is not being good with sex. And that's the fear of a lot of collegiate young men and you know, well, young men and young women, I would imagine. And it seems like he's just kind of like, if there is an innocent here, it's like the real innocent, you know, kind of caught up. Maybe talk about him and about what Brendan brings to the table.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, Brendan and I have become fast friends. He's a really good writer as well. And he's been sending a script around for a little while that I've enjoyed quite a bit. But the Ron character himself is a little bit nerdy, and he's got, you know, his best friends are all women. And, you know, a lot of where he's coming from and a lot of what all the characters are coming from are these sort of nerves about leaving their small town, leaving their clique of, you know, being in a high school and going off and being alone and being new. And for Brendan and for Rob is, you know, it's sort of a legitimate worry, is like, you know, I'm worried I'm not going to be any good at this. I've never done it before. You know, I'm worried I'm not going to be any good at this. And to be sort of candid around all of your girlfriends, yes, it's a bit of a joke, but I think there is truth to it. It's a joke in the moment. It feels a little jokey, but there is truth behind it for sure.
I think all young men are terrified that they're going to be bad at sex, that you know, somehow, you know, women will know. You know, they talk about that in Risky Business, you know, college girls can tell.
Yeah.
And, here he is, you know.
Yeah, exactly. That's funny.
Go ahead, Al.
I was going to say, I have to say, if when I say it, it doesn't sound like much. Because it's been done a lot, but you did it very well. The whole having Cotton pixelate in to some of the shots, you know, he's watching Cotton, suddenly her face pixelates, her shape pixelates, her face turns to look into the camera at him and so forth.
Yeah.
That idea has been done a lot, but I thought you did it really, really well there. It felt fresh when you did it.
I appreciate that, yeah. Yeah, we were trying to do, you know, again, it's this object is pulling from her digital facsimile. So within her digital realm, which is Kyle Jr.'s recordings, that's a lot of what it's pulling from, because Kyle Jr. has so much from her room. He's really fascinated by Cotton, so she shows up a lot. And thus, like, that digital universe becomes even the playground where she's killing her friends as well. But really, it's again that facsimile of her anger and all the resentment and all those things that, you know, that fear drives, fear of losing each other and fear of moving away and never having the friends again, fear of something new. So I think that's sort of where Cotton comes from, and I appreciate that that the digital realm was playing well.
Well, you know, in the beginning there, we see him, and he's, you know, all these different cameras are active. Mm-hmm. Are we going to see a sequel with the other cameras?
I mean, some of them are my family. So, I mean, they're available, you know. They're not working, so potentially.
Go ahead, Al. I'm sorry.
I think that might be an interesting aspect to look for shorts or a series or something, as he's sort of the fish keeper in all of this, and that across the different realms, he's the constant because he's the one watching.
Yeah, that's interesting, actually. That's pretty interesting.
What I was going to say is that I thought you talked about the Crypt Keeper. I'm thinking the old woman at the sale where the
the $10.
It's the character Miriam Smith plays. Mm-hmm. I'd like to know more about her because she seems to know quite a bit about the cube. And is she the pinhead essentially, or the representation of pinhead essentially for this particular realm, and so forth. I think that any kind of origin story, I probably would like to see a boosted up version of this character.
Mm. Yeah, I picture the old woman sort of being like she had played the game before and lost.
Uh-huh.
And now is the Crypt Keeper to start giving it away to somebody else. And potentially once somebody gets it and they lose, then she's set free. And then the next person becomes a Crypt Keeper and the next person and the next person.
That could be. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, ad nauseum, right? That could be sort of, again, this object sort of transposes through time. It could be in the past, it could be in the future, it could kind of be anywhere. But I think that's a really fun, it's a fun idea. It's a fun idea, guys.
Well, you know, when I was watching it, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead, please.
I was going to say, when I was watching it, I was expecting, you know, some of the standard tropes that, maybe she's the person that's played this and lost, or maybe she's the one and passing it on. But at the end there, when you see her glitch, that makes you wonder if she's not an extension of the cube somehow.
Mm-hmm.
About the reality, she's the one introducing this chaos to see what will happen, because out of chaos comes order.
Mm-hmm.
She's sifting through the issues, she's vibrating the different realities to see what shakes out.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's so open-ended. I think there's a lot of different versions of what that could be and how you can interpret it. And I don't mind that one, especially when you're talking about multiple realities and if it is pulling from a different reality that she no longer exists in, and it's, you know, that's what's making her flicker. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it was unexpected. Going by the tropes, I expected to have the camera pan back to her now empty slot.
Right.
And fulfilled her obligation to try to expose it to someone else, has moved on, but then we see her flicker, so more stuff could have happened.
More ladies. Some ladies might play it. Some older ladies.
Right. So, old ladies, play the game.
Yeah.
No, I do have a question about, did you use practical effects or CGI for your kill scenes?
We kind of did a marriage of both. So for... I mean, there's spoilers in there, but for the big stomach stabs and things, those are all practical. And a little bit of stewing guts and all those sort of things, again, are practical. Anything with blood is practical. And then we've added in a little bit of extra splash or a little bit of extra gore sort of around the edges. So it's sort of a marriage of both. And then most of the visual effects stuff does come sort of in this digital realm, as we've kind of called it, where cotton kind of does most of the damage. But yes, all the effects were practical in that way, and there wasn't a ton, because it was a cosmic horror. The whole intention was to be cosmic, so it was a little bit more like what you don't see and what you don't get, and then some splashes of violence to kind of really offset that.
I want to acknowledge that it was most effective. I think that there was a midriff or a gut shot, exposed guts from, was it cotton? Azusa, where you do see. I thought that was effectively done. Because you actually it looks quite realistic. I'm not sure what material you used. For that, but it actually looked like blood and guts, unlike some films where you see something incredibly cheap and it looks obviously fake.
Yeah.
Not here.
Yeah, I think like stirring, because that's actually with Courtney, I think is what that is. But it's the stirring of the guts that really kind of sells that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Brendan and Kelsey did a good job there. And we did hide a lot of it and then only really show a little bit of it.
Right. But that's what makes it most effective.
Right.
It makes it most effective. Yeah.
You see the death before you see what caused the death. And I think that's kind of how you really make something visceral in a lot of ways.
Well, we're big practical effect fans here because
of course, I bet.
Gidgel stuff thrown around too much. And so putting Gidgel on sparingly in the corners is really the best way to have any Gidgel effects. And of course, for the digital world, everything had to be Gidgel. I mean, if you could have managed that with practical effects, that would have been really cool. I would want to see that.
Yeah, yeah, most of it is, you know. But, yeah.
See her pixelate on her own.
Yeah. Most of that is not. I should say that is not practical effects. Yeah, I get what you said there.
Yeah. I'd love to be able to do that at an convention somewhere, just start to pixelate. But, yeah, no.
I think they kind of, you know, like Possessor, Brendan Cronenberg does a lot of that. Weird, like a lot of that stuff's in camera effects.
Yeah.
That is practical mixed with, there's not even really mixing a ton of visual effects. There's a lot of practical in there.
Now,
that would be nice to be as well.
Yeah, it would be. You know, when we do these podcasts, we come on as friends and fans of the producer and whatnot and then the movie. But I'm going to say something just a touch negative.
That's fine.
Police detective, just for me, didn't come off well.
Very good.
I just didn't feel like she was like a police detective. She felt like somebody else's mom stopping by. Hmm. Which, granted, when you're a teenager, is just as bad as the police.
Yeah.
Oh, you know, because I grew up in a very tight knit community.
Mm-hmm.
But,
so did I. Yeah.
Thing about the whole thing was that, yeah, I just, that one left me sort of lukewarm.
Fair enough. Miranda, though. I do love Miranda Edwards, who plays the police detective.
I thought the actress was fine. I'd like to see her a little more smartly dressed, a little more professional, per se.
Yeah.
We do keep it honest here. We try to, because if we are, straightforward, then when we compliment the film, you know it is true, and it's not just, you know, blowing smoke up the filmmaker's ass. One comment I did have, and this immediately hit me, and I think it hit Kevin as well, and also wanted to touch on your experience with Shudder. The look, and you mentioned the composer, it was Blitz Berlin, is that the
Blitz
name?
Blitz Berlin.
The film had excellent sound design, it had excellent Foley work. It looked and sounded like a cinematic production.
Great sound.
On the back end, you couldn't tell in the finished product, and that is the mark. I think we can all agree that is the mark of a good filmmaker. If you were scraping pennies in the back, but your end product looks like this, you did something right.
I appreciate that. Thank you. Yeah,
we've seen production with big budgets, and they spend it in all the wrong places. I am a frequent critic. I know I am in the vast minority when I say Terrifier. Holy God, what kind of lighting did you choose? When every scene is hot pink, it's hot pink out in the street at night. It is hot pink in an abandoned warehouse. I do not understand it. It completely takes me away. There's no immersion whatsoever. I appreciate watching a film, and it reflects somewhat real life, maybe a little darker, a little bit more moodier. But yes, please, God, don't go over it with a Crayola crayon, for God's sake.
Yeah.
That was just a compliment. That didn't require an answer. But I wanted to, because we've had a number recently of filmmakers being represented by Shudder, which I mentioned is one of the top horror platforms. And when you think, where can I find really good horror, right? Mm-hmm. It's Shudder is always in the conversation and always has been. But talk about your experience with Shudder, How did that partnership come about?
Yeah, I mean, Shudder sort of came on board through our distributor. So I wasn't really involved in a lot of that. We were lucky enough to get RLJ involved, sort of right at the end too, while we were selling the film. And then RLJ had a deal with, I believe they had a deal with Shudder, and we ended up in like AMC theaters, and in Canada we ended up with Level Film, and we had good sales to kind of get us out there so people can really see the film, which is fun. And yeah, I mean, Shudder being sort of like the premier horror streamer out there, we're really lucky to be on there. And the fact that you guys got to watch it all there is always cool. My first film ended up on Netflix for a while, and that was like a really big deal. And like, this is sort of a great partnership for, I think, this film. Because it is trying to reach that audience. And I did want to comment on the sound design, because we did kill ourselves trying to get that as good as it got. With like a really good friend of mine, Eugenio Battaglia, who's a real rising star as far as like sound design is concerned. He's a good sound mixer, but he really prefers to be doing sound design. He brought in the Foley artists and all those kids, sound effects and all that. And then Matt Drake, who was our mixer and our post soup and one of our producers, like he was just in the trenches with me in the end. And we were killing ourselves to get it that good. So I do really appreciate that was listened to and appreciated as well.
Oh, I always appreciate sound, because it's more than just the orchestral or, you know, the composition, you know, the background music. It's more than, you know, leveling the different voices. It's basically the stew of the film. It's it's the sonic assault, as you will. It is, I think, one of the core immersion factors when you're looking
absolutely
at the film.
Absolutely.
You need sound design, and you can easily tell, for someone who's watched a number of films, you can tell immediately if they paid attention in post-production. How serious were they on putting out a good film? You can tell by the sound design.
Yeah, and like our schedule was insane. I mean, to be perfectly candid, like we were trying to make a bit of a different movie when we set out to make it, really to be just sort of vibey and really layer in all the cosmic stuff. And when we were originally talking about the movie, you know, the multiple realities and multiple universes and quantum everything was a lot of the conversation. And then Marvel just kept doing more and more multiverse stuff, and then other people are doing multiverse stuff, and then we were like, okay, well, we don't really want to do multiverse stuff anymore. And we ended up sort of wanting to have this really tonal music and sound design forward, sort of trippy cosmic horror. And the further down the line we got, it sort of became more of like this like thriller elements and a little bit more of the horror elements in a quicker film. And not to say that that's good or bad, it's just sort of how it all came together and how fast we had to shoot and how fast we had to put it all together in the end. And like the attention to detail while we were in there was crucial, and we tried really, really hard to kind of keep it all together, and I think we ended up with something quite fun. But like, being totally candid, that's sort of where the movie wanted to be originally. So the sound design and the music was always in the back of my mind to be the thing that really leads a lot of the experience. So it does mean a lot to me to hear that.
Well, I'm going to tell you that while Anthony was talking about sound, for me, it's visual. Mm-hmm. Lighting designs. I have seen a number, as a reviewer, I've seen a number of films that have basically been handled so badly with day for night shots and lighting, mm-hmm. Schemes, As Anthony was talking about the Terrifier series, you know, everything is washed in pink. And yeah. I'm
it's like a bad white balance.
Yeah, and I'm looking at this film, the way it's framed, the way that it's lit. This is the look of a major production.
This yeah, is I appreciate
the,
that too.
Yeah, and you yes. And you have especially the scenes inside the what was it, inside the rave or inside the club mm-hmm. where some of the action was taking place. I really felt like I was there. The neon lighting was such that it looked real and it looked harsh and it looked effective to me.
That's Christopher McQuarrie level framework and sound design right there. If anyone's familiar with the Mission Impossible, because they do a lot of, you know, Tom Cruise walking through a club, walking through halls,
that laser was beams and all that kind of shit. Yeah, I know them well. I'm also a big fan.
But the coordination as well. We can go on. We can go on, Scooter. Mm-hmm. It's the sound design. It was the lighting and also the coordination of the clubs. Putting it all together, you get this almost masterclass in framing a shot in a very busy shot. And we're talking an independent film here, guys. We're not talking about something that Blumhouse put together, right? Or Lionsgate, right? This was you did it. You got people who you knew together. You cobbled the money together. You put it together, and it was shot extremely well. So you definitely deserve credit for that, and I hope everyone is able to catch it on Shudder. But before we go, how long is it going to be on Shudder? Did they give you kind of like an ETA for when it's going to come off?
That I don't know, actually. They don't really tell me a whole lot once we've finished a movie. But that was, the cinematography is Farhad Guderi. He's a rising star. He's going to be big. He's a really good director as well, but mostly he's shooting all kinds of stuff in Europe and in Canada and the US, and he's like Mexican and Iranian. He's shooting a ton in Mexico. Like he's a real sweetheart too, and he's going to go a long way. So we got really lucky. He's a good friend of mine. Got really lucky to kind of pull him into the fight. So yeah, and like his favorite review, we haven't had a ton of good reviews, but we had a good review that he liked that was to kind of speak to how small the budget was that the review was, I just love that they had they had a couple pennies in a dream, and it really kind of shows, so I think that was nice. Anyways, it is a very tiny movie, so it was good to see that some people really enjoyed it. And thank you for enjoying it.
Oh, you're so welcome. Scooter, before we get ready to wrap this beautiful show up of the Fest, where can our followers find you on social media?
Yeah, basically at Scooter Corkle on Instagram. That's really kind of the place to go, I think. The beauty of having the name Scooter Corkle is that I have scootercorkle.com and all these other Scooter Corkles. Anytime you kind of find those, they're usually me. I haven't found any fake ones yet. And maybe by the time this podcast comes out, somebody will steal it from me. But now I'm fucked. But but either way, at Scooter Corkle at Instagram is probably the easiest way. I'm like off most social medias currently. I've been off for about a year, and I feel a lot better about myself, when you're not doom scrolling.
Oh, you're not missing a thing, trust me.
No, I know.
I will tell you, it took him a while to respond to me on Facebook.
It did,
As far as that is concerned, but you were so apologetic about it. I was just like, wow, no worries whatsoever. Get away from social media. Absolutely. But it told me something about the type of person that you are that you were so apologetic about it. It was, but if there's any other Scooters out there, you are fake. And you will be found out.
Yeah, Scoot McNary. God.
That's it.
Hey, at least you don't have a last name like me, man.
There you go.
Flynn?
Yep. Even though I'm not related to either Earl Flynn or the actor Joe Flynn, at least I'm still alive, I think.
Yeah, or Johnny Flynn.
I don't know. You might be a voice in the podcast.
Yes.
You might just show up here. How creepy would that be, right?
Yeah. What reality are you in, really?
Hey, with your movie now in our brains, what reality are any of us in? Is this even real that we're talking now?
Is this literally the Matrix? Are we literally in the Matrix? Are we plugged in currently?
You fucked with our brains yet again, Scooter. Thanks.
You're welcome.
Well, Scooter, I want to thank you very much for taking the time and talking with us this evening about The Friendship Game. It was a good movie. I would say screw the critics, although Kevin might take that as a personal insult.
I do not in this instance.
No, I appreciate that, guys. I really do.
You know, we always say you put your best foot forward. If you have a vision, you execute it to the best of your abilities. I know many films that probably had stronger showings that didn't make it to Shudder, right? That didn't have their films on Netflix, right? They didn't have the viewers. You really don't know. It's just the way the cookie crumbles sometimes. Sometimes you can put together what turns out to be a masterpiece and it's not picked up. Nobody sees it and it's left in the can. Other times you make a film, you swing for it and you just happen to hit a triple. And, you know, someone notices you and says, I like what you did. You know, I like that scene that you put in the club. I mean, that was perfect. That was perfect. It just said, this is my guy for this project. You know, you never know. So, and it's in the biggest place it could possibly be in Shudder. So, it's no great arguments there. You made it.
And Scooter, all the best with your upcoming projects.
Yeah, appreciate that. I'm actually talking to you from my writing studio currently. So,
I was going to say, is there anything that's like Mission Impossible related that Tom Cruise has maybe called you about? And just
oh, say, hell, hey. Kevin. I mean, I'm starting to write with a writing partner, and it's been so fruitful. I've been really enjoying it. Normally, I write by myself, and it's a very lonely process. So being able to spitball and yell at each other and really kind of nail down what an idea is has been great. But we've been writing Mission Impossible size movies. So our first one is a big action movie that mainly takes place in Venezuela. And our second one is a big sci-fi that goes from a colony on Mars back to a destroyed Earth. So, I mean, you know, I'm not really writing anything for myself at this point. Just
if you can squeeze a part for Ethan Hunt, you know, just a little cameo or something like that.
Who knows? Maybe Tom, he shows up in Venezuela.
Tom may be game for it, you know?
Well, come on, how about the movie where that Mission Impossible is going back to the prime dimension to find the sphere, destroy it. He's got to go get it to stop all this from happening. And so Tom Cruise is going through the multiverse and getting ripped apart in the process.
Oh, I love this. Imagine him and his whole team having to like battle with, you know, staying friends or not. And it's all about how the world will crumble if they don't stay friends together.
And all while you're playing the Lalo Schifrin theme. Dun, 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 dun.
Yeah, come on. Exactly. Yeah.
That is so okay. We are geeky Mission Impossible fans here.
I
so
can tell.
We're going to put a bow on this before we go crazy.
Yeah. Yeah.
All the guys on that team have so many secrets to start with. They'll be stabbing and shooting each other in the first 30 seconds.
Al, you want to take us out?
As always, thank you for watching. Well, thank you for listening. And remember, keep America strong. Watch horror films.